capture. You know, if you've got a large antenna and you use a tuner to transform the impedance to something that keeps the radio happy, you still got a large radiator up in the air. Mag loops aren't large.
Let's see if I have the repeater. Okay, very good. What Alan is alluding to is also called aperture. Dick has mentioned it in the past. You know, he explained that an infinitesimal dipole, although electronically corrected for zero reactance, has approximately the same size aperture of radiating as a full-length antenna, which doesn't make a lot of sense at the beginning, but ultimately that seems to be the case. Another point that I would like to add to Alan is that because magnetic loops have such a small radiation resistance, we're talking at the highest frequency, you might have a radiation resistance of about 1 ohm. And when you try and use it for the lower frequencies, the radiation resistance plummets to a thousandth of an ohm. So introducing an antenna tuner, unless you're getting it from JPL for $10 million, is going to introduce a significant amount of insertion loss, which is going to make your situation even worse, not better.
Well, you got the numbers wrong. If I could build a mag loop with a radiator resistance of 1 ohm, I'd be in hog heaven. More like a hundredth of an ohm.
Okay, I don't know what to tell you. I've seen documentation of people throwing those numbers away around, but the point is that it plummets to a really infinitesimally low radiation resistance as you go lower down in frequency, which is what you were discussing right before. So if you got a tenth of an ohm of radiation resistance, the insertion loss of even a nice antenna tuner is going to shred that entirely.
Yeah, that's great. Now, an interesting fact, the efficiency of any antenna, is the proportion between the ohmic resistance and the radiation resistance. And since in the mag loop, the radiation resistance is so small, ohmic resistance becomes intolerable.
WY2U.
Yes.
Hey, Roy, Al, and Rich, this is Mike, WY2U. I was listening for a bit. I got a couple of things I could point out there, Roy, if I might, about the mag loop. In fact, if you want, about any antennas, go ahead.
Sure, I would like to know things that you know, Mike.
Okay, hey, how you doing? I'm sure Al remembers me, maybe he doesn't, but him and I went to Queensborough Community College together back about 1963. Al, we're both showing our age. One correction, if I might, Al, before I continue. The efficiency of an antenna is equal to the radiation resistance divided by the sum of the radiation resistance plus the loss resistance. The denominator has two terms. It's RR divided by parentheses RR plus R loss. Go ahead.
How are you, Mike? I remember you. Thank you for correcting me. I bow to Mike's expertise, but, you know, it's kind of the same thing that the ohmic resistance becomes intolerable. But he's correct. It's the sum. He's absolutely correct.
Okay, if I may continue there, right?
Certainly, Mike.
Okay, thank you. With regard to the loop antenna, first of all, Rich, for your benefit, if you want, I developed a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet, that really takes a compilation of all of the design equations from multiple sources, some of which came from John Krause, his famous book on antennas. Skin depth comes into play when you talk about losses in copper conductor. And I kind of convolved them all together. When you put in the diameter of the loop, the diameter of the conductor, the required amount of capacitance you need to resonate the loop. And I also compute Q. I also compute the radiation resistance, the loss resistance, the voltage across the capacitor, about everything you need to know. Let me drop a minute. I also make an estimate of what the diameter of the coupling loop should be. You're kind of on your own how to space it and how to position it, but you get an average calculation for what the proper diameter of the coupling loop should be based on the parameters of the main loop. Now, one thing you said, Al, before, which I absolutely have to agree with you on, the proper way to tune a mag loop is in two shots. The first thing you have to do is resonate the loop with the tuning capacitor. Forget what the SWR is. A very simple way to do that, Al, as you pointed out, is to take the radio receiver, tune to your program, just tune to the operating frequency, carefully adjust the variable capacitor until you hear maximum noise. Let me drop. The good news, Rich, is that maximum noise will occur even if your VSWR is excessive. A 40-to-1 VSWR will still give you a resonant system where you can easily detect what maximum noise is. So forget about what the SWR is for the moment. Excuse me, but it's absolutely imperative that you resonate the loop with the tuning capacitor. Once you have done that, for all practical purposes, you don't have to touch the capacitor again. There might be some slight interaction when you muff with the coupling loop, but it should be pretty much insignificant. Now, once you've got the main loop resonated with the capacitor, then it's time to misshapen, if necessary to do so, the coupling loop, perhaps reposition it closer or further away as needed, maybe even turn it back or forth out of the plane of the loop while you're measuring SWR using an impedance bridge, a VSWR bridge, a VNA, a Berg watt meter, whatever. But then the loop is properly adjusted. The adjustments are twofold. Resonance first, match second. Rich, I'm going to give it to you if you understood that first. Go ahead.
Okay, but to resonate the loop with the capacitor, you have to go through the coupling loop, or else where is the coax attached to, Mike?
The coupling loop could be attached to the transceiver just as if you were going to transmit through it. Again, a 40-to-1 VSWR will still give you a peak in noise. Very easy to hear. Atmospheric noise is about 40 dB above thermal noise at most HF frequencies. So it's not, it's easily discernible regardless of what the match is. You have the radio receiver connected through the coupling loop to the antenna, and you're adjusting the capacitor. You can even close your eyes. Don't even look at what the SWR is. Just tune for maximum noise. Rich, okay?
Okay, I thought maximum noise would automatically mean lowest SWR, but you're saying the two aren't related?
No, I'm saying they're absolutely mutually exclusive. I don't care what the SWR is. You have a filter that is tuned to some frequency which is coupling energy in and out of space. In this particular case, you're coupling energy from noise, which is predominantly atmospheric at HF frequencies. That atmospheric noise will peak when the circuit happens to be at resonant frequency. I don't care what the VSWR is. It would be nice if it was 50 ohms, but you can still hear a peak in noise even if the VSWR is very high, Rich.
What you're saying, I could actually take just the matching with the variable capacitor, just the matching the outer loop, I can take the coax and connect it directly to either side of the outer loop without the coupling loop involved at all, and listen for maximum noise, and then attach the coax to the coupling loop and adjust that. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely not. When you take your 50-ohm coax and connect it to the outer loop, you're putting in the wrong value of resistance in a high impedance circuit. you can relate to, the loop actually is a series resonant circuit when it's resonant. However, there is what is known as Cower equivalent, C-A-U-E-R, after the radio engineer who discovered the property. You can take any series circuit and convert it to parallel. The parallel impedance of a resonant loop is hundreds, well, maybe not hundreds, but several tens of kilo-ohms, perhaps as high as 100 kilo-ohms. You take a 50-ohm coax from a transceiver and connect it across that mag loop, the main loop, and you're going to detune it to the point where you're not going to be able to hear anything. Use the antenna as it was intended to be used. Connect the transceiver to the coupling loop. Tune for maximum noise. Then do not touch the capacitor. Monitor SWR and try to position the coupling loop in, out, various angles. Maybe you want to misshape it. Maybe you want to make it an oval. Maybe it wants to be round, square, whatever. Whatever you need to do to the coupling loop to lower the SWR down too close to unity. You now have a properly adjusted magnetic loop for that frequency. Rich, go ahead, WI to you.
I agree with everything that Mike said, but I would like to put it in different words.
Okay, Alan, feel free.
Okay, and I'm sure that Mike will agree with me. Resonance is defined as the absence of capacitive or inductive reactance. It's purely resistance. When you're adjusting that tuning capacitor and peaking the noise, your resistance at resonance could be 600 ohms. It could be 1,000 ohms. But it's going to be the peak. It's going to be the noise peak. After you've adjusted that tuning capacitor for the noise peak, don't touch it again. Now adjust the coupling loop for minimum SWR. Do not make any different connections. Do not put your coax any place else. Put your coax exactly where it's going to be. When you're adjusting that tuning capacitor, you're adjusting for resonance, not match. Once you've achieved resonance, now you can adjust the coupling loop for match. Simple as that. Back to net.
Absolutely correct, Al.
Okay, Mike, I would love your spreadsheet because I never heard anybody dealing with the diameter of the coupling loop and things like that. So are you good at in QRZ?
I am, yes. And if you go to the QRZ page, it probably will have my email address there on top. Email me. I'll get your email. I'll send it over to you. It's an Excel spreadsheet. As long as you have Excel or one of the Windows Word or Excel Office, that is, work-alikes, you can open it up. I want to point out one more thing that this spreadsheet does that a lot of the programs I have seen on the Internet do not. Let me drop a minute. A lot of the programs and calculator sheets that I've seen on the Internet correctly calculate parameters in the loop as far as the diameter, the resonant frequency, how much capacitance you have to add, all of that. But what they do is they very much overestimate what the efficiency is. They do not take into consideration the Q, or the loss, if you will, of the tuning capacitor, which could be significant. Remember, you got a radiation resistance that could be on the order of 0.01 ohms, maybe even less than that. The tuning capacitor may have a ESR, or equivalent series resistance, of maybe a tenth of an ohm. And the copper loss in the radiator itself, the main loop, might be on the order of, again, about a tenth of an ohm. An appreciable loss could be in that tuning capacitor itself. Now, there are ways to mitigate that. There are various topologies of capacitors that minimize the ESR. Vacuum variables, I've seen a couple where they have tubes within a tube that use air as a dielectric, and all of them are fine. Let me drop.
Okay, W.
I'll get it right to you, Al. But if you use a conventional tuning capacitor with plates that are held in place mechanically on a tuning bar, the ESR of those caps are pretty poor. Butterfly capacitor is a little better. Vacuum variable capacitors, better still. Tubes and tubes, even better, but depends on what your choice is. Anyway, I go through all of that, and I estimate what the Q of the capacitor is, too, based on a couple of simple graphs. And this way you can get a better feel for what the efficiency of the actual loop will be. Let me give it to Roy first, then to you, Al. Back to net, WY2U.
Okay, AC2GS, thank you very much, Mike. Alan, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I certainly did. Q is very important. I don't like vacuum variables for a couple of reasons. You can't solder them into the circuit. You have to clamp them, and that introduces an upset. Band design is 30 years old, but John Fortune, W6NBC, did that tube within a tube. He calls it a coaxial capacitor design, which I think is an advancement over my design. Mine is unnecessarily expensive. However, the butterfly capacitor works, provided you weld the plates of the stator in place. Ted Hart, his formulas and his design rule, and I would love to send you his formulas so you can compare them to your own. Mike, over to you.
Sure, Al, please do. By the way, your signal got a little bit weak there for a while, but it came back strong to the end. I got the gist of what you said, though. Yeah, by all means, Al, look at my QRZ page, get my email address, and send me all of his equations. We should be able to correspond to each other back and forth and compare notes and compare theories and opinions about, you know, what's good and what's bad in the magnetic loop. I felt about six of them myself at various frequencies. Oh, and Roy, I want to say one more thing, if I can, about loop size, if I might.
Sure, Mike.
Okay, this was not pointed out before, but I believe it's extremely important. A magnetic loop, to be a magnetic loop, must be small with respect to the wavelength of the highest frequency signal that you want to send through it. It has to be no more than about a third of a wavelength in circumference around. If it's longer than that, you've gone above self-resonance, and you no longer have the ability to use a tuning capacitor, first of all, to resonate it. It's already self-resonant with itself. To make it even longer, it starts looking more like a dipole that's folded on itself rather than a loop. The bad news is when you start making the loop longer than about 3/10 of a lambda around, not only do the equations are no longer valid, but the parameters and the radiation patterns start to become distorted and fall apart. So to be a true magnetic loop, once again, the total maximum diameter of the loop should be no more than about 0.3 lambda or so at the highest frequency where you're going to use the loop at. Back to net.
NBC.
Yeah, I did. Alan, someone doubled with you. Alan, you want to go first, and the other person can go second.
Okay. Mike is correct. Once you get above a third of a wavelength, the capacitor has to be negative. In other words, you need an inductor. It's not a mag loop any longer. You need a little capacitance, but the more capacitance you have, the lower your efficiency. So I think in terms of meters equals feet. If I want a 20-meter antenna, then I'm designing for a 20-foot circumference. And the capacitance will be quite small, something on the order of 22 pup or something like that. But once again, it can't be fixed. You have to adjust it. Just like when you have a quad, you have to adjust front to back by adjusting the reflector. You can't just cut it and expect it to work. It has to be tuned. The mag loop has to be tuned, and that's just the way it is. But maximum efficiency coincides with minimum capacitance, and that will also mean minimum voltage at the capacitor. So with my designs, you can run power because I run monoband, and I don't like vacuum variables at all, vacuumette.
I never thought about that, Al. Feet equals meters. That's a pretty good, that's a pretty close rule of thumb. I got to keep that in mind. Bassinet.
Okay, very good. I just want to know if my ears need de-waxing. I kind of thought, Mike, that you said that the diameter has to be 0.3 lambda. I assume you meant the circumference has to be 0.3 lambda.
If I said diameter, you should applaud me. I meant circumference. I'm so sorry if I said diameter.
It's okay. I misuse words. You know, they did that. Especially words that I used about 12 times in the previous 5 minutes, so no problem. Who was the person who was doubling, though, with Alan, who wanted to say something?
It's me, Roy, DC. Mike, can I give you my email address?
Sure, no problem at all. Just got to give me a second to turn around and get a piece of paper and a pencil. Stand by.
And QKW?
Yes, Alan?
I want to give Mike Myers my information as well, but I did want to make a comment about radiation pattern, because I have no way of measuring it. But I'm told that when you go above a quarter of a wavelength, that a mag loop has a radiation pattern like a donut, like a toroid. But when you go above a quarter of a wavelength, it starts to fill in on the sides. It's not as clean, which is fine with me because I don't rotate my antenna. So if the antenna is more omnidirectional, that suits me just fine. And Mike, if you're back with a pen, I'm N2KW at ymail.com. Yeah, Y like Yankee, ymail.com. Over.
Okay, I got you, N2KW at ymail.com. Rich, let me get yours, please. Over.
Mine is W2BZ, Bravo Zulu Radio at gmail.com. W2BZRadio@gmail.com.
Okay, let me get mine out there, too. Mine is a conglomeration of myself and my wife. So mine is DM Delta Mike Cosma, like my last name, DMKOZMA, at optonline.net. OPTONLINE.net. I have no problem giving it on the radio. The whole world knows it anyway, but DM Cosma at optonline.net. Back to net.
Okay, very good. Everyone's swapping emails. That's the way it should be. I run the roster for another club, and I try to get people to share their email addresses and their phone numbers with fellow club members. Because, you know, it's a fraternal, you know, organization. We're not going to send each other junk mail.
No, of course not. Hey, by the way, Roy, I got one more comment for Al. He had a question about why the loop pattern changes between quarter wave circumference and three-tenths of a wave circumference. I have the answer for that.
Sure, I'd love to hear it as well.
Okay, the typical equations for the magnetic loop make one assumption, that the current is uniform. Within about half a dB or better, for small diameters loops, and that's absolutely correct. And if you go through the radiation pattern of a uniform current distribution, you find out it looks like the Michelin Man around the loop. It does have nulls in the plane of the loop, just like a dipole would have nulls off the ends of the dipole. When you make the loop a little bit bigger, those nulls fill in, and the reason is because the current is no longer constant around the circumference. It changes from about plus or minus half a dB at maybe three-tenths circumference. At a quarter wavelength, I take it back, at a quarter wavelength, it's about plus or minus half a dB. I said it backwards before. when you start increasing the diameter, I said diameter again, the circumference to about 0.33 lambda, it's now about plus or minus 1 dB out of uniformity. That tends to fill in the nulls in the direction of the loop. So instead of being a uniform current, it now has about a 1 dB error in it, and that gives rise to the fact that the loop's a little more omnidirectional without the deep nulls off to the side. That's the explanation for it, simply because the current distribution changed. Back to Ned, WIQU.
Okay, that's very interesting to know. Thank you, Mike.
Anybody who's interested, the math's a little bit heavy, but it is readable. John Krause goes through the whole explanation in his beautiful 1950s book, Antennas. There's also a second edition that came out a couple of years later. But he goes through there's one chapter on small antennas with about 8 to 10 pages devoted solely to small loops. Anybody who's interested in the math should use that as research material. He actually does go through the whole thing very nicely.
Mike, you should caution people. I have thumbed through that textbook, and reading the matrix equations almost gave me a nosebleed.
Well, the good news, the pattern, the radiation resistance, and the field equations for the small antennas aren't that terribly bad. He doesn't derive them. I guess the derivations are even beyond what he wants to explore in the book itself. But he states them, and they are readable, and they are usable. So it's not too bad for that one chapter.
Okay, I'll take your word for it, Mike. I've noticed a dramatic difference between postgraduate level antenna theory textbooks and antenna theory textbooks designed for amateur radio operators. It's kind of like see Dick, run Dick, run.
Nothing wrong with the ARRL handbook, by the way, if you want to just get a quick and dirty cookbook for antenna design. That's a fine book. For those people that want a little bit more, well, there's more available higher-level books at your disposal. But the antenna book by the ARRL and a few others, believe it or not, are perfectly fine textbooks.
I disagree.
I'm curious, has anyone read Rob Hamill's antenna book? It's a German publishing company.
That's UKW.
It's Alan.
The ARRL antenna book published the design for a DPRR antenna that they said you should go to a muffler shop and have them bend stainless steel pipe to make the antenna, which introduced ferrous losses. It was just a terrible design. It was horrible. Whoever wrote that article didn't know what he was doing, and the ARRL just published it.
I have seen a couple of errors in that book, too, but in general, Al, I think it's a fine book. There's even a more glaringly obvious design error that I think was in the same edition, where a couple of engineers claimed they made an improved rhombic antenna using two rhombic antennas that are sort of co-folded on themselves, and they claim something like about 20 dB of gain or something like that. If you work out the equations, there's no possible way that could be correct. Yes, there are errors in the book, but you can take them with a grain of salt. Back to Ned.
Okay, very good, Mike. Thank you, Alan. Thank you, Rich, for introducing the topic. We were lucky to have Mike and Alan around to bounce it back and forth. Antenna theory is fascinating. I mean, even if you're not interested in magnetic loops, what you might want to take away from this discussion, at the very least, is that when antennas are resonant, it has nothing to do with their impedance, per se. Some antennas are resonant with an impedance of 400 ohms or 1,000 ohms or 2,000 ohms. So as Dick used to say, first you resonate, then you radiate. You reach a point where there's no reactance, neither capacitive nor inductive, and then you supply a match to match whatever impedance is left as pure resistance to 50 ohms so that your transmitter can transfer the power as efficiently as possible. So if you just take that away from the discussion tonight, hopefully you've learned, gotten a better appreciation for what resonance truly means. Any last words from anyone before we move on? Rich, I'm sure you have a lot to think about now.
Sorry, Roy. I was washing some dishes. Yes, I have a lot to think about now. I was misled by every video that I've ever seen on a MagLoop. People are just tuning the capacitor, the variable capacitor, and I guess they have the coupling loop optimized already. That's why they just consider the variable capacitor whenever you change frequency. All right, back to that. Thanks, Mike, and thanks, Al.
Okay, and thanks to everyone who participated tonight. I hope you learned something. I certainly did. Anyone else with any closing comments before we move on?
M2KW.
Yes, Al?
Yeah, I want to comment on the difference between Mike and I. I'm in awe of his competence in math. I certainly am very rusty. I never had that proficiency. My experience is all hands-on, and when we agree, it's beautiful because he understands the underlying theory, and I understand what works in the field. So when we agree, it's a beautiful thing. Over.
Well, thank you for the kind words, but if theory would stop agreeing with practicality, well, then we're both in trouble. So, yes, theory is important. As long as you can realize the implementation of a certain design supporting the math by hands-on measurements or whatever, I totally support that. Nothing wrong with empirical measurements. When sometimes you just can't do the math, it doesn't exist, and you're left with doing an empirical type of an analysis or a measurement. So I'm glad to hear that, Al, and we should be collaborating on mag loops and other things in the future for sure. Back to net, WI2U.
Okay, I doubled with you a little bit, Mike. I'm sorry for that, but I got the gist of it. Thanks to both of you guys, people with a lot of practical knowledge, people with a lot of theoretical knowledge. You put those things together and no one can beat it. So thank you both for joining us here tonight. Okay, we have Wesley. Wesley, what's your topic for tonight? Wesley, we're having the same problem we had last week, only worse. You're down by about 20 decibels in audio. A little bit better, but not much. I can barely hear you. You're not getting through to the repeater. It's as though you were whispering from across the room.
Okay, just give me a moment. 1-2-3-4, 1-2-3-4. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay. So first, Dick used to say, receiver antennas are more forgiving. You want to comment on that?
I think we talked about this last week, but I'm more than willing to repeat myself. There's a whole bunch of different reasons for that. Receivers are high gain, low noise, front end amplifiers. And so if you have a mismatch, a couple of microvolts of power getting reflected back into the antenna, and a smaller percentage of energy is traveling to the high gain antenna, a high gain amplifier, but it's still enough to pick up most signals. Whereas if you flip the equation as far as transmitters go, if you have a mismatch and it reflects back onto your transmitter circuit, having a transmitter that's supposed to be outputting 100 watts that's being fed to, you know, 20 or 30 watts is going to shorten its life expectancy unless it has a lot of safety features, and it's far less forgiving. So the ultimate example is receivers can basically work through a terrible mismatch, whereas you wouldn't have a long life expectancy for your transmitter if you tried to do the same.
Thank you very much for that. Static electricity, very simple thing. So, capacitor is a device used to store electrical charge and electrical energy, and it is made of at least two electrical conductors or plates separated by a distance. And the question is, why capacitor needs to be shorted when it's not connected?
If I understand the question, it's purely a safety aspect. If you do not short the plates of a capacitor, you don't know whether the plates are charged or not. And if you assume that they're not charged, and they are, you can get electrocuted if it has sufficient charge to accomplish that. So it's, as far as, if I understand the question correctly, it's a safety thing.
So you say discharge capacitor doesn't have to be charged if you're sure that it's not charged?
Okay, I'm completely confused with what you just said. I thought that you were talking about the safety aspect of always discharging a capacitor when not in use so that it has a known charge of zero. I'm assuming from your response that that had nothing to do with your question.
The answer was very much correct. But let's say we have an uncharged capacitor. Does this capacitor need to be shorted when in storage?
Again, I would say yes, because just because you didn't charge it doesn't mean environmental factors won't charge it. So although it's less likely, it's not unlikely. So that would be my answer.
So, for example, we have a 1 microfarad capacitor, and it's stored for a few months. You assume that it would be charged on it. Where did charge come from?
I would assume the same things that produce random static charges in the environment. Hopefully you're not going to tell me that the RF is kind of acting as an antenna and just sucking up the RF, because those are alternating currents. So I don't think they're really leading to a great deal of static charge on capacitors.
That's UKW.
Salad.
Yeah, well, you know, I was almost going to disagree. I was almost going to say once you put a screwdriver across the terminal for the capacitor and it's discharged, that it's not going to charge itself. But it's still good practice to store it with a shorting bar across it. By the same token, there's no such thing as an unloaded gun. Over.
Yes, indeed. Matter of fact, John KD2BD, who's a regular, he hangs out in the chat room. Unfortunately, I don't think his radio can make it into the repeater. He just wrote down dielectric absorption. So it's not incredibly likely, but it is possible. So better safe than sorry. The same thing goes with guns, as you pointed out, Alan.
No, certainly isn't going to hurt to put a shorting bar across the cap, although one microfarad is kind of small, but, you know, maybe 30 or 40 mics, you know, good filter cap and electrolytic. You know, when they're charged and you short the terminals, it sounds like somebody shot a gun, bang.
Yeah, you see a lot of that. I made a nasty comments about YouTube, so I'll say something nice about YouTube. They use the banks of high capacity, high voltage electrolytic capacitors rather frequently to do all kinds of interesting experiments. I was watching YouTube the other day in which someone is producing very, very small samples of the miracle material graphene, which requires a burst of electrical energy. And, it sounds like a lightning just went off.
Yeah, well, you know, when you work around high voltage equipment, you generally have something that's shaped like a fish hook, but much larger, and with a cable connected to ground. And that's the shorting bar, and you hang that over the high voltage before you work on anything.
So, do you say some sort of atmospheric factors may charge the capacitor, especially high voltage capacitor? Could you polarize, not polarize? And that's why the safety factor should be applied. Can you specify those factors that makes the capacitor charged?
Yes, it's a bill.
Yes, Jeff.
Would not the wind or maybe even a cat brushing up against something help along the charge?
And 2 kW.
Yes, Alan?
That has never been my experience that a capacitor reaches a hazardous level of charge by itself from cats or dry air or any other environmental factor other than being charged in the circuit. My experience is once it's discharged, it's discharged. But once again, there's no such thing as an unloaded gun, and there's no harm in storing the capacitor with a shorting bar. I refuse to speculate on what could charge it.
Thanks, Alan. Let me just check that I have the repeater. Good. I think the devil is in the details. I think we're not really talking about a massively charged capacitor. We're talking about a very slight electrical charge that just kind of deposits itself on a capacitor, and probably more likely to occur on a non-polarized one, because if these random acts happen, they can randomly happen in the opposite polarity and disrupt the workings of things like electrolytics. So I think in reality, when Leslie can talk for himself, obviously, he's sort of talking about non-polarized lower capacitors that kind of can pick up a slight charge in the environment. But please, I'm sure you want to tell us the answer to this question that you brought us today, Wes.
Unfortunately, that is not true. It could be having severe shock, and that is because of recovery voltage that will happen between the terminals. So that's why it is the regulation, not only suggestion, to be keep a especially high voltage capacitor. So, what is recovery voltage? Any answer?
So you're not really talking about a fully discharged capacitor. You're talking about a discharged capacitor that wasn't really fully discharged, and the internal structures allowed for some of the charge to not quite be dissipated at the time that you shorted it.
Well, I was just giving this question, what is the recovery voltage? And what do one wants to respond? The voltage appearing between the electrodes of charged capacitor after it's discharged by short-circuiting its electrodes, at least that's the way that it's known or described as recovery voltage. There are certain test methods, especially known for the electronic engineers, which in which the electric absorption of the capacitor is calculated from its recovery voltage. And even if we keep the capacitor for half of a year or 1 year with short terminals, and yet then you make it open after a certain period of time, you may notice that it is quite nice voltage on it, especially depends what is the voltage and what is the capacitance of the capacitor. That's especially present in high voltage capacitors. So I was hoping that somebody's going to give more answer about it.
Again, it seems to me that recovery voltage is not an external phenomena, but an internal phenomena of a given capacitor, that you could only discharge it so much and some of the residual charge kind of gets stuck someplace and redevelops on the plate over time. But these are not voltages that are induced external to the capacitor. They're just hidden away someplace and slowly are recovered onto the plate that exists in them.
It depends what kind of capacitor we're dealing with. Sometimes it is the ionic forget the word activity. Sometimes it's the electrolyte that is in the capacitor, and sometimes the structure of the capacitor that actually makes it recharge. I was always puzzled with it, but I got shocked with a 100,000 volt capacitor short for a few months, a few times in my life. Never critically. So it is usually estimated that recovery voltage is between 3 and 17% of the capacity of the capacitor. So with peak capacitors, we may see a quite nice shock.
Okay, but apparently most of the cause for this charge phenomena is the dielectric. So what happens is an electrolytic capacitor is a complicated structure. It has conducting plates on either side. It anodizes a non-conducting separation by electrolysis. And there's a dielectric fluid that the two plates and the anodized surface are sitting in. The dielectric itself isn't usually discharged fully. It's the two metal conductive plates charges that get discharged rather rapidly. The underlying charge that is sitting inside the dielectric liquid material itself, or the paste material, slowly ends up charging up the plates over time. So it's an internal, not an external, as far as I understand it, an internal phenomenon based on the dielectric. So I would assume that you wouldn't see such a recovery if you were using something like a vacuum capacitor.
That's a good question. I believe you are absolutely right. Anybody can correct me. Yeah, especially vacuum capacitors, they don't have high capacity. No. When the electrostatic discharge energy is high enough, it can ignite a fuel vapor and air mixture. So, we're talking about fuels, flammable fuels. My question to you is, why our tank in our cars is relatively safe? And to issue.
It's to Bill Cummins.
Yes, Jeff.
So I happen to have a box sitting here in my shack where I've got a bunch of stuff for repairing and refurbishing Astron power supplies. And I happen to have a pile of 64,000 microfarad
what are they, voltage, 25-volt capacitors, several of them sitting in this box, which have been untouched for about 2 years, I'd say. And the terminals are not shorted, and they weren't touching anything. So I measured the voltage across each one of them, and each one was about 250 millivolts. And I shorted one of them, and it measured zero. So there are no cats or strong winds in the garage, so I really can't really comment on how those would have affected it, but these did not build up anything dangerous. I'm not sure if it's the voltage or the capacitance which is dangerous, but in this case, there was no strong voltage built up.
Okay. Ultimately, it's the current that's presented is the big problem. That's the difference between a tickle and a heart attack.
Yeah, I also have a pile of very, very high voltage capacitors, the ceramic types, and I measured those, and they were all zero voltage.
Now, a question for you. What is the capacitor of the ceramic capacitor?
Significant in anything but electrolytic. And I think when Wesley's talking about, he's really talking about heavy-duty, ultra-high voltage capacitors that most of us don't really, you know, work around, thankfully.
Thank you to Bill. Yeah, he asked a question. I've got a bunch of NPOs that are all rated, 5 kilovolt and above.
And 2 kW.
Yes, Alice?
Just to play devil's advocate, because, you know, this has never been my experience, but I've seen, filter caps, high voltage filter caps with a wire across the terminal to let you know that it's not charged. Just like I said, you don't assume that a gun isn't loaded. Every gun is loaded. So you have to assume the capacitor is charged, but it's just got this little wire across the terminals. It obviously can't be charged, or else the wire would get hot and start a fire. You know, it just tells you there's no charge there.
I suggest quickly put in your Google search engine why the words why terminals of high voltage capacitors must be shorted when in storage all the time, whatever. And then you're going to have plenty of answers.
That presupposes the answer, doesn't it? That question is a loaded question.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. Would you please repeat?
I said the question presupposes the answer.
Oh, yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Well, in other words, it's a safety standard, but safety standard comes from the facts. And facts are caused by the factors. So that would actually explain that a capacitor could be charged. For many of people, unexpectedly, and they don't know why. So that's why I mentioned recovery voltage. I would like to go to another thing, which is electrostatic discharge of energy that can ignite fuel vapor and air mixture. Why our tanks in our cars are relatively safe from that?
Well, it's kind of obvious that you have an answer for it. General gasoline is not quite as explosive as bad movies will have you think it is. They usually have to vaporize it and mix it like a carburetor with air to get those enormous, incredible flames. But, you know, anyone who has seen a car on fire knows that that isn't how real cars burn with their gasoline. If anything, lithium, electric vehicles with lithium burn more ferociously than gasoline does normally in a tank.
Any other comments?
M2KW.
Yes, Alan?
It's my understanding that the gasoline is what burns, the fumes that burn. and the tank is sealed, then the fumes are contained, I suppose. Although, once again, I'm sure that he has the answer in mind.
Yeah, I'm sure he does. It's a combination, as far as I understand, internal combustion engine. And that's the whole point for the carburetor, is the carburetor vaporizes the gasoline and mixes it with oxygen from the atmosphere. It's also necessary to mix it with oxygen. If you just have a tank of gasoline and it's sealed up and there's no oxygen in the tank, there's nothing for it to burn. So gasoline isn't terribly flammable. I believe diesel is even less so. It's more difficult. I understand that if you just pour a little diesel fuel on the ground and throw a bunch of matches on it, the matches just go out. Whereas if you did the same thing with gasoline and gasoline vapors that are kind of given off at the in the little puddle that you've made, it'll light up. So, yeah, I would agree.
That's 100% correct. I have a diesel, and you can make a puddle, throw a match in, and it'll go out.
Yeah, it's a very safe fuel. I was watching some YouTubes about the old M1 tank, and the original design was for diesel, although the very sophisticated engine, which basically is like a jet engine, is capable of using both kerosene and gasoline as well, but they prefer diesel for a bunch of reasons. It also had very good quality of acting as further shielding for the tank.
Now, Rudy Diesel designed his engine to run on peanut oil.
Well, there's all kinds of interesting designs for engines. I don't want to kind of twist the subject completely out of whack. I'm sure Wes had a point to make.
Yeah, so we have a vapor in the chamber, and a little spark is able to ignite it. And the question is, actually it's not a question. It is known fact that vapor, fuel vapor, in air mixture is very much sensitive to electrostatic charge. And the reason that is that electrostatic charge is safe is not because it's not enough of air there, because if you have a vapor, that part of the vapor can have a right proportion of mix to explode. It is just static electricity requires separation of positive and negative charges, and it doesn't happen there. You have all metal. And then I was thinking about that answer because I've read that answer. And I was thinking, somehow there was gasoline engine, contained gasoline structures are not metal. Why then this is safe? And that I don't know the answer for it.
I don't really know a great deal about gasoline containers, what the materials are made of. I've never really heard of any gas tank going off with static electricity. The usual story I've been told is some guy who's pumping gas and smoking at the same time starts a fire at the gas station, but I don't think that happens with inside the tank itself. So it's my lack of expertise in this particular subject, Wesley.
That's UKW.
Salad.
They caution you at the gas station that you have to use a metal container if you're going to take gas to go, and it's got to be on the ground when you fill it. There's a reason for that.
Yeah, well, the first thing in any electrostatic, separation of charge. If that doesn't happen, you have no opposite structure that could interact, because once the separation takes place, we're talking about difference between the levels or difference of potentials, minus versus plus and whatsoever. And ratio.
N1YDY.
Yes, Hank. Long time no her. Here.
Okay, well, I can only tell you that in aviation they love to do demonstrations where they show